Let's turn to the book of Genesis, to chapter 50. I want to, this evening to look at verses 15 to 20, but we're going to read from the end of chapter 49, verse 33, into chapter 50. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such as are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Now when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am dying in my grave which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back.' And Pharaoh said, 'Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear.' So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. And they went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father, and when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, 'This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians.' Therefore its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan, and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who went up with him to bury his father." Verse 15, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him.' So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, 'Before your father died, he commanded, saying, Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones.' And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them." Don't know if you heard that story about three tough, mean-looking fellows on motorbikes. One time they pulled into a truck stop cafe, and inside, sitting at the counter, was a truck driver, smallish chap, just sitting there quietly eating his lunch. And these three big brawny bikers came and took the food off his plate, and then they laughed in his face. Well, the truck driver didn't say anything. He just got up and paid his bill and walked out. To which one of the bikers, disappointed that they hadn't managed to get a reaction out of him like that, he bragged to the waitress, "Not much of a man, was he?" "Well, no, I guess not," she said. And then, glancing out of the window, said, "He's not much of a driver either, because he's just driven his truck over three motorbikes out in the parking lot." I suppose that is the way of the world, isn't it? If someone crosses you, you cross them back. Don't get mad, you get even. You hit me, I'm going to hit you back twice as hard. That's the way many people in this world tend to respond if they find themselves wronged in some way by someone. That's the reaction. But when it comes to Joseph, however, we've seen, haven't we, as we've worked our way through his life here in the Genesis account, that's not his way. Even though, as we've seen, he's been wronged repeatedly by different people in different ways, Joseph, for his part, he never responds in that way. He never gives as good as he gets. He never hits back twice as hard. Rather, he's always seeking to do good. He's always seeking to have his branches reach over the wall and to honour the Lord in whatever situation he finds himself. And it's something we see coming through here in these final verses of the book of Genesis, this scene that we have here with the brothers following the death of their father Jacob. The brothers are in fear at this point, that even though Joseph had forgiven them all those years ago, now with Jacob, their father, gone, perhaps that had been a restraint acting on Joseph. Perhaps now with Jacob gone, maybe Joseph might change. Perhaps his attitude towards them might change. He might now take that as an opportunity to exact his revenge. That's the way they're thinking. But it's not the way that Joseph is thinking. Because as we see here, Joseph continues to look at things, as he always does, from a Godward perspective, confident that the Lord is in control of all that happens to him, good and bad, and that he's directing all for his good and for the accomplishment of his own wise purposes. So this is something that we want to consider this evening. It's helpful for us, isn't it? Not only if we've been wronged or crossed by somebody in some way, but also just helping us to process the ups and downs, the highs and lows, the vicissitudes of life. How can we remain positive and joyful in the midst of life's trials? There are two things that we can learn from these verses that we've read together this evening, and really sort of sum up two big themes actually in Joseph's life. One is he relinquishes the past, and then also he remembers God's providence. Let's think about these two themes. He relinquishes the past. This is verses 15 through 19. When Joseph's brothers saw their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." So this is the scene in chapter 50. The great patriarch Jacob has finally passed from this life to be with the Lord at a ripe age of 147. His sons are there, if you remember. They're all gathered around his bedside. They heard his final words of blessing and prophecy as well before he died. We've been looking at some of those in recent weeks, some of the things that he said to his sons before he breathed his last. But now he has. Jacob has finally passed from this life and his sons have buried him. Verse 13, according to his wishes, it says there, they carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought for a burial place. After that, then, Joseph and his brothers, they returned again to Egypt. But as they do so, there seems to be some sort of anxiety has crept into the brothers' minds collectively here with regard to Joseph. You can see it in verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." So this is their concern. This is their fear. It's an irrational one, given the way Joseph has been towards them. But this is what they're thinking, that Joseph may now hate them, they think, and turn against them. That now with their father gone, any restraint or control that there may have been when he was in the room, well, now it's no longer there. And so this is what they're thinking here, that Joseph may now, as a result of that, he may repay us, they say, for all the evil which we did to him. What do they mean by that? They're thinking about all the things that they'd done all those years ago when he was just a lad of 17. The hateful words, the contempt, the disdain they showed, throwing him into a pit, turning a deaf ear to his cries as he was calling out to them for help, and then selling him as a slave and separating him from the father he loved and who loved him. All of those things and more besides that they had done, and for which they now think Joseph might be planning now to exact revenge. And so fearing that, verse 16 says, they sent messengers to Joseph saying, "Before your father died, he commanded saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you.'" Now, whether this is real or not, whether Jacob really did say this or not, it's a matter of some debate. You can read around. There are differences of opinion on this. A number of the reliable commentators think this is probably just a ruse on their part, and that Jacob didn't say this at all. They've made this up. It could be. I mean, we don't know for sure. But either way, they're saying that this is their message. Dad said, you've got to forgive us for the evil that we did. This is the message that they send. And then they follow that up by making the plea in person. "Please," they say, "forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father." And they prostrate themselves before him, even offering themselves to him as slaves in order to make amends. So this is their impassioned and anxious plea, driven by their fear that they have now come together to make. It's an irrational one, really, as we said. They didn't need to do this. Joseph had forgiven them already. We know that by what we've already read in the whole story, that elaborate situation that Joseph himself orchestrated, withholding his identity from them for that length of time, and then keeping one of them captive in Egypt while he sent the rest back to get Benjamin, then hiding the cup in Benjamin's sack in order that all of them might be humbled and broken by that whole event, and how they would then be led to confess how badly they had acted towards him in the past. Which is what they did, they acknowledged that. And Joseph then, as we saw back in chapter 45, he'd already forgiven them. He'd been reconciled to them over those things. You remember those powerful words in chapter 45, verse 5. "Do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." He forgave them for all of that. He saw God's hand in all that had happened, and then he followed that up with that outpouring of brotherly affection for them. Chapter 45, verse 15, he kissed all his brothers and he wept upon them. And then, as if to further confirm and underscore his restored love for them, he then had them relocated to be with him there in Egypt. And he's generously cared for them, provided them for them ever since, for 17 years now. I mean, there's no logical reason for them to think this way towards Joseph, or to expect such a dark, sinister response from him. So why would they think that way? Why would they project that kind of reasoning onto him? Maybe because that's the way, isn't it? As we said at the beginning, that's the way things tend to be out in the world. Ungodly people in those days, as they do today, they often tend to respond in that manner. They will nurse grudges for years and years and years, just biding their time, waiting for the right moment to hit back. Some people do think and act like that. So maybe they're tarring Joseph with that kind of brush. But we know Joseph, don't we, from what we read, he isn't like that. He never responds in that manner. We see that again and again. And look at the reassurance he gives them here. "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" Again, he sees everything through that God-shaped lens. That's his first response in every situation. It's always a Godward one. As he did when he first revealed his identity to his brothers. "You yourself sold me here," he said. "Why? For God sent me before you to preserve life." He factors God into the whole thing, seeing it always in terms of who God is and what God is doing. And here again, it's a similar thing with the brothers fearing that he might be given to thoughts of reprisal and revenge. He immediately brings God into the equation. He sees it all in terms of God. "Am I in the place of God? Can I sit in the judgment seat of God?" No. Only God can judge rightly. Only God can really judge the hearts and thoughts of men. "Vengeance is mine," says later on, doesn't it, in Deuteronomy. "Vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I will repay." And so we're not to take vengeance into our own hands. We're not to go seeking vigilante justice. But as Joseph does here, we leave it with the Lord. He is the judge of all the earth. Shall not the judge do right? And it's as we ourselves think and reason in that way that we too can know something of the peace, the contentment that Joseph had. He wasn't consumed by anger and spite. He wasn't being eaten up by this desire to have revenge. In his heart, this matter's already been settled. He's already forgiven them. He's already let this go. This is done. It's in the past. And judgment for it, well, that's in the hands of God. The matter's settled as far as he is concerned. And so he's not going to go back digging it all up again. Rarely does any good, does it, to do that. To refuse to forgive a wrong that's been done, or even if it has been settled, just to keep going back over it in our minds, that rarely does any good. Think about the parable that Jesus told about the unforgiving servant. That man who was forgiven a great debt himself, but then he refuses to forgive that man who owed him much less. And then you remember the king found out about that, and the king was furious, and he handed that man over to the jailers, it says in the parable. And that Greek word there, jailers, it can also mean torturers. And it's interesting, we studied that some time ago. And I remember one of the commentators made this comment about that term, torturers. He said this: "The world's worst prison is the prison of an unforgiving heart. If we refuse to forgive others, then we are only imprisoning ourselves and causing our own torment." And that's the way it can be, isn't it? Sometimes the most miserable people you can meet are people like that, who refuse to forgive. Even though the matter's maybe been dealt with, it's been sorted out, but still they go over it. Still they go back over this, they spend their days, maybe their nights as well, stewing, brooding, being tortured over what others may have done to them in the past when they've crossed them, and they just can't get past it. They can't get over it. When the best thing to do, as Joseph does here, is to leave judgment with the Lord and move on. Leave it with him. Don't keep going back over it. Do you remember that story I told you about Robert E. Lee, the great Christian Confederate general who, after the Civil War, he visited a lady who was very upset that during one of the conflicts, this grand old tree which had stood in the front of her yard for years and years had been destroyed by the artillery fire of the Federal Army. And so General Lee was there at her house, and she was looking to him to get his opinion on this and maybe some condemning words from him concerning those northern troops. But he just looked at this tree and said, "Cut it down, madam. Cut it down and forget about it." That was the best thing to do there. Rather than keep looking out the window, looking at this thing and being all stirred up by it, no, cut it down. Don't keep bringing it to mind. And that's what Joseph does here. He relinquishes the past. He's forgiven his brothers and he's focused now on doing good. And so these are things we can learn from Joseph here about living faithfully in amidst the vicissitudes of life. Relinquish the past. But then one more thing from verses 20 onwards. Think about this. Remember God's providence. "But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about, as it is this day, to save many people alive." So Joseph here continues to show his brothers the perspective he has on all that's taken place. God is ruling. That's how he sees things. Always. God is in control. He's on the throne. He's directing all of these events. He's using it ultimately for good. "You meant evil against me," he says, "but God meant it for good." Now, the word "meant" there is an interesting word. It's a word which means to think something out very carefully. It's to calculate. It's to premeditate. It wasn't random what they'd done. It wasn't haphazard. No, this was something they thought through. It was premeditated, intentional. "That's what you did," he says to them. "This was your intention. That's what you meant. You meant it for evil, but," he says, "God meant it for good." And it's the same word, meant. The brothers meant evil, but God meant, planned, determined it for good. Meaning, not that evil isn't evil, but that God is able, sinlessly, to use the evil actions of sinful men. And to so govern and direct them that he can, in the end, bring about and accomplish his own ends by them. That's what he's saying here to his brothers. "You actively devised and conspired, plotted evil against me, but God, in his all-wise sovereign providence, he took your scheming and devising and conniving, and he actually used it to bring about good." Now, in what way? You may say, how did he do that? What good did he bring about? Well, he tells them there, "in order to bring about, as it is this day, to save many people alive." So all that's happened to him then, going back to that time when he was 17 and the brothers sold him as a slave into Egypt, he ends up in Potiphar's house, then he ends up in Pharaoh's prison, then he ends up in Pharaoh's palace, and then at Pharaoh's right hand, he's prime minister over the whole land. All of that came about because of the brothers' evil plan to begin with, but God used their evil deeds without being guilty of their sin. He used their evil deeds ultimately to bring him to a place like that, the palace, from where God could use his skills to stockpile those grain silos for 7 years so there'd be enough food supply, not only for Egypt, but also for the surrounding nations as well, and his own family throughout those dark years of famine. So that millions of lives would be spared, including his own family, the covenant family, who would then be relocated to Egypt, and then eventually, under Moses, that nation would be led out of there, and eventually they'll come to the promised land. All of that, you see, was being put in place by the actions, the evil, sinful actions of the brothers. They meant it for evil, but God, in his all-wise sovereign providence, he meant it, he used it, he overruled it for good. The Heidelberg Catechism defines providence like this. A beautiful definition. Providence is the almighty and ever-present power of God by which he upholds, as with his hand, heaven and earth and all creatures, and so rules them that the leaf and blade, rain and drought, fruitful and lean years, food and drink, health and sickness, prosperity and poverty, all things, in fact, come to us not by chance, but from his fatherly hand. All things, extending evil, even to the evil things done to us by fellow sinners. God isn't responsible for them. He isn't the author of them, but he is able to use them and overrule them to bring about his own good and perfect ends. Even the activities of the devil. Calvin, he makes this comment on these verses. He puts it like this. Whatever poison Satan produces, God turns it into medicine for his elect. That's what he can do. The devil means harm by it. God brings health by it. The devil plots evil against the people of God. God uses it for their good. There are many, so many examples of this in the Bible, aren't there? Just to give a few. The persecution of Christians in Jerusalem. We've been looking at that recently, haven't we, in the book of Acts. Saul is there, he's going about, he's dragging them out of their homes, he's having them thrown into prison, having them tortured. That's the evil scheming of Saul as he was then. That's the malice of the Sanhedrin. But the Lord then uses that to scatter Christians out from Jerusalem, out to Judea and Samaria and the rest of Palestine and beyond, so that before long the Gentiles are hearing the gospel now and the Gentiles are being saved. Or think about Paul himself later on. He's arrested, he's thrown into prison in Rome. That was the sinful actions of ungodly men. But Paul wasn't perplexed by that. He's rejoicing in that, isn't he? He's telling the Philippians to rejoice about that because God was using that for good. He says, the things that have happened unto me have fallen out for the furtherance of the gospel. Because there he was chained to those Praetorian guard, four different ones, 24/7. The gospel was spreading throughout the army. At the end of the letter to the Philippians, he can say, the saints in Caesar's household greet you. God makes the wrath of man to praise him. Men meant it for evil. God meant it for good. And the greatest example of all took place at Calvary. Good Friday. What happened there? That was the wicked actions of ungodly men. Peter said that, didn't he? Acts chapter 2, verse 23. On the day of Pentecost, he's standing before the Jewish nation there. This is 50 days later. And he's saying to them, you. It was you. You nailed him. You nailed him to the cross and you put him to death. But then almost with the same breath, he says, he was delivered over by the predeterminate plan and foreknowledge of God. So yes, it was ungodly, evil men. They were guilty. They were responsible for committing that greatest of all sins that was committed in all of human history. But at the same time, Peter says there, it was also according to the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. Isaiah chapter 53, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. And so it's providence, Joseph is saying. God's sovereign providence is arching over all things and directing them so that evil, when evil seems to prevail, God can still use it to bring about good. That the devil's poison, as Calvin says, God can turn and make it to be like medicine. Last Sunday we thought about Bunyan, John Bunyan, being thrown into Bedford jail. He was there for 12 years. It was the ungodly actions of the magistrates. They didn't want him out there preaching the gospel. It caused him tremendous suffering. He was separated from his wife and his blind daughter for 12 years. Immense pain it caused him. It was an evil thing. But while he's in there, in his isolation and separation, he writes a book. He writes a spiritual classic, Pilgrim's Progress. It's one of the best-selling books in the history of the English language and has brought untold blessing to millions. Men meant it for evil. God meant it for good. Is there something like that in your life? Some situation that's come about in which someone or some group of people have crossed you. They've done you down in some way. They've got one over on you. They've made you to suffer in some way. And that thing is still there in the corner of your mind. It still comes out. You've tried to cut that tree down, but still it keeps coming back. You still keep thinking about that in your spare moments. Why did that have to happen? Why did God, allow that to happen to me. And it just kind of eats away at you. I mean, Joseph could have done that, couldn't he? But he doesn't. He sees it all from a Godward perspective and reminds himself it was the Lord. It was God who was at work behind it all, directing, controlling, sinlessly overruling it all for his good and to bring about even greater good. And so that's how we need to see all those kind of events that happen to us in our lives, isn't it? And I'm talking here not just about the slights and the injustices that we experience at the hands of other people. Really, we need to apply this to all the dark providences, all the painful trials, the pits of despair, the smashed hopes and dreams. Over all of those things, we can say, God allowed this. God permitted this. God meant this. He did. He planned this. He meant this for good, for my good and for the good of others. There was an American man some years ago. His name was Jay Bufton. He was a 52-year-old husband. He was a father, a high school teacher, a coach as well. And he developed a terminal cancer. But he was a Christian. And in his room, hospital room, 5020, that room, it really became a sort of a beacon of hope for friends and family and even the hospital staff as well, because of his disposition, a joyful one, and his very strong faith. Nurses actually asked to be assigned to him. Some of them would even come and see him during their out-of-work hours. So that as his once fit athletic frame began to waste away, still he continued to greet anyone and everyone with a smile and an encouraging word. Well, eventually Jay's body did succumb to the cancer, and the Lord called him home to be with him. At the funeral, his pastor noted that room 5020 had a special meaning, in that the Bible also has a 5020, he said. That really sets forth a similar kind of principle. It's here, isn't it? Genesis 50:20, in which Joseph, looking at the trials and sufferings that he'd been through, he could trace it all ultimately back to the hand of God. Yes, it was hard, it was painful, but he knew that God in his sovereign wisdom and power had allowed it and was using it for his own all-wise purposes to bring about good. Well, so too in that room, the pastor said there, room 5020, the Lord has done a similar thing, using those sufferings, different kind of sufferings, of course, that Jay was experiencing, but all ultimately coming from his hand and being used by God to sanctify Jay and also to bring tremendous spiritual good to others. That's the wonder, isn't it? That's the mystery of providence. It doesn't always spare us suffering. Sometimes it leads us right into suffering. But in the wisdom of God, he makes it a tool in our lives to conform us more and more to the image of Christ, and very often at the same time to do tremendous spiritual good to those around us. It's one of the biggest lessons that we can learn from the life of Joseph. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face.